Take a network break, grab a virtual donut, and join us for our weekly analysis of IT news. We've got a guest pontificator today, Brad Casemore. He's Research VP for Data Center Networks at IDC. Today's show is sponsored in part by ThousandEyes. On November 7th, you are invited to Cloud State 2018, an exclusive event in San Francisco where ThousandEyes will unveil the results of its first annual Public Cloud Performance Benchmark Report, a data-driven, unbiased comparison of the three major public cloud providers, that's AWS, Azure, and GCP. Register now at ThousandEyes.com/cloud-state-2018. That's ThousandEyes.com/cloud-state-2018 to find out who wins the cloud wars. And just want to let you know, the presentations from our October Virtual Design Clinic are available on ignition.packetpusher.net. If you're not already a member, you can sign up for free and you get access to all the VDC content. That includes three technical presentations and a whole bunch of Ask Me Anything sessions with our expert panelists. Head on over to ignition.packetpushers.net. All right, to the news. Cisco has announced new 400 gigabit Ethernet switches.
Hey! Woo-hoo! They don't get to claim first.
Yeah, Arista beat them by a week. 1 week.
Yeah, that's... and then somebody else got their 400 gig switches out a few weeks ago as well. I think the white box community got them out first, which is great, but it's definitely not something that enterprises will much care about. I doubt that most enterprises have a passionate need for 400 gig. Brad, this is really your area of expertise. What do you think?
Yeah, Greg. I mean, you know, obviously the first adopters of 400 gigabit Ethernet in the data center, they will be the hyperscalers, right? They're chomping at the bit, and this technology is long awaited in their environments. You'll have some telcos looking at, you know, telco cloud implementations, and they may need it kind of the second wave. Enterprises are third on that list, and there'll be some financial services company that'll be first up within the enterprise community. But this is primarily, at least in its early days, it'll be a hyperscale phenomenon.
I don't think it would be HFT. I don't think they're all that fast. It's switch latency that matters. I don't think that propagation latency is all that significant inside the data center.
Yeah, so, there's different apps, but you're right. For the high frequency trading, it's more about latency than it is about raw bandwidth. Yeah,
it's not. But getting from 10 gig to 100 gig is worthwhile because that gives you, you know, 1,000%, a substantial decrease in propagation latency. But going from 100 gig to 4 gig only shaves a few more nanoseconds off and doesn't really... I doubt if it even shaves too many nanoseconds off because your own cable's only 100 meters long.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And, and you can see folks are getting, like, I think Arista made a purchase just a short time ago where they're getting right down to the physical layer for
Metamaco.
They're trying to shave even more latency off.
Yeah, those L1 switches are quite popular and they're interesting market niche for those types of people. They also do some other interesting things to do, you know, at very high speeds. But anyway, I think these Nexus switches that Cisco, there's probably one unique factor here is the fact that there's a 9300, which is the chassis-based version.
Yeah.
And I think they're the first ones to do a chassis-based version of 400 gigs, which suggests to me that maybe they can get some of these into the, or they're targeting the cloud companies who do need a lot of 400 gig.
Yeah, and it's very interesting, right? I know one of the things that was a sort of mystery Cisco was reluctant to disclose, it was the merchant silicon in the new switches, these Nexus 3Ks. And we believe it's the Innovium Teralynx silicon. If you look at the data sheet, it matches up extremely well. In fact, it's almost a perfect match for all the attributes and specifications that Cisco put forward.
That was my speculation. It was either Barefoot or Innovium, because if they're not going to say it's Broadcom, because they have deals in place with Broadcom not to talk about, you know, if they started saying they were not using Broadcom, there'd be some poopy being thrown around and some hissy fits, I think.
That explains their reticence to disclose, yes.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. And the Innovium is actually a group of ex-Broadcom people who left and made this 12.8 terabit per second chip, but it's not a programmable pipeline. Again, it's just a very high-speed fabric. Very interesting because we've always said that I think that we didn't, that companies like Cisco never wanted to get totally dependent on a single supplier.
Yeah.
And the fact that Cisco's giving Innovium a run might be sort of throwing their weight around with purchasing weight around with Broadcom and saying, we don't actually need you, you know.
We do have options, yeah. Yeah, which is interesting also because the Arista 400 gig switches we talked about last week are built on that Tomahawk 3 and Cisco's stepped away from that for this batch of the Nexus 3400s.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. That's one thing the big network OEMs and the hyperscalers have in common is that all of them would like to lessen their reliance on you know, the a dominant supplier for merchant silicon. And it's something that, you know, there have been many efforts put in place, right? You've got within OCP the whole Sci initiative and all the work that's been going on there to create these layers of abstraction. Yeah.
But shifting to someone else's silicon creates its own problems, right? The code that they now use to program the forwarding plane has to be rewritten.
Yeah.
And typically Cisco, when Cisco does that, the code quality is not very good. And particularly people have been telling me that they're continuing to have odd software problems inside of the Nexus platform. So introducing a new switch will probably cause stability problems for a lot of people, even with things like Psi and so forth. So whereas the, you know, if you just kept sticking with the Broadcom, Broadcom nominally keeps most of the API the same. So the code doesn't need a massive rewrite. And in theory, your code quality should be better. So I'd be concerned about that.
That hurdle, I mean, explains probably a lot of the inertia in the market, right? I mean, there are things you have to do as you move from one vendor silicon to another. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we saw Cavium pull out of the market.
Yep.
They shuttered their Ethernet switching business unit. So that really only leaves, as far as I know, Broadcom and Innovium barefoot.
Marvell still has silicon, but it's the silicon they had before the acquisition of Cavium. And my understanding is that, you know, they're not, at this point, they're not in a tremendous number of
design-ins.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. They had a deeper programmable pipeline, more stages of programmability. It still wasn't as programmable as the barefoot, but they did have a fully programmable, I think it was like a six stage or an eight stage pipeline, and that set them out differently. But I think that's interesting. I hadn't thought of Innovium, although it was on my sort of back of my mind, but they've got some good switches. We've talked about them in previous shows.
Yeah, and they settled a while back, of course, it's now quite a while back, right? They settled that whole litigation issue with Broadcom and so forth. So I guess they've got free rein now to
clear to play.
And the other thing I noticed, Drew, was that Cisco's using QSFP-DDs and QSFP-28 optics modules, whereas Arista was going with the OSFP and then talked about perhaps going. So again, Cisco's gone down a different pathway here. I haven't quite been able to get to the bottom here, but my guess, Brad, is that Cisco doesn't want to re-engineer the chassis. They've got that rather odd Nexus 9300 chassis, which is a certain height. And if they had have gone with the OSFP, which is a bit wider to get the thermal dissipation and the power delivery, this QSFP uses a different sort of technology. And I'm guessing that Cisco's betting that they can keep the same hardware factors, so that keeps their internal price. They don't have to redesign the chassis and redo all the airflow and the validation of that, but they get to sell more expensive optics. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting, right? Because that is another point of, Arista will support both, but clearly they're more in the other camp, right? And they're pushing that hard, and they're pushing it as a technologically superior alternative. So it is another point of divergence between Cisco and Arista, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah,
I know the Arista folks are very opinionated on that point, although they will support both, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, it's too hard. I find it a bit challenging to understand the technical details between the two, but it looks to me like the OSFP makes more sense as a cheaper optic because it's just easier to make. Whereas Cisco's saying, now I think that's probably a decision that they've made before. So, you know, they're still out there pushing 10 gig/40 gig. They really haven't even gotten serious with 25, 50 gig. I'm not getting feedback from anybody saying, you know, we're buying 25 gig and 50 gig and 100 gig switches. Cisco's really still out there pushing the 10/40s. Yep. And I think Cisco does that partly because once the sales machine gets up to operational speed, it's like a train lumbering down the tracks. It can't turn left or right. It has to run down the track that's been laid out for it. And I think that changing that, and they're also putting in the BIDR modules again. So they're investing. Which again is, I'm not a big believer in BIDR. I think it's pretty pointless. And at 400 gig, I don't think you actually want to use your existing fiber infrastructure. I'm a much better believer in using active optical cables. You should be out there buying AOCs and running switch to switch. Because if you're going to run 400 gig over your existing fiber, you're probably going to have to rerun your fiber. I think that's a dumb thing.
Yeah, and that could be why they've listed it, right, as a capability and a feature. But it didn't get top of line play. I think it's it's almost in there for folks who are having those internal discussions inside their organizations, and they're kind of trying to rationalize how they move forward.
Yeah. And they're saying, oh, we don't have to. But I would strongly not recommend using BIDR. I'd get active opticals.
Yeah.
I did the last piece of real work I did was with an active, and we ended up using active opticals everywhere because the cost of the fiber, and more importantly, every time we patched the fiber, it just didn't work quite substantially. And we had the cost of doing fiber testing and retrofitting and all of that embuggerance was just so bad that in the end, we just bought very long active optical cables and it was cheaper overall.
Well, Brad, thank you for helping us solve this mystery on who the merchant silicon provider is for the Nexus 3400s. That was bugging me because they wouldn't tell me.
Oh, no worries. It bothered me when they wouldn't disclose it. I'm sure you guys felt the same way. It was like, well, I got to find out who this is.
Yeah, I was looking at different spec sheets and I forgot to check Innovium, so I'm glad you guys had that covered.
It seems odd that they wouldn't talk about it, though. Is it like, you know, they don't want their brand undermined, do you think?
Maybe because it's essentially a new silicon provider and they're worried about uptake if people know that they may be suspicious. I don't.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, maybe they're particularly confident and they want to have a run at this while, you know, Innovium is still a new player. Yeah.
Well, this is their first chip.
Yep.
But it's not like they're proven, so maybe they don't want their competitors to be out there undermining that on the basis of, you know, do you really want to buy a first generation ASIC?
Yeah.
You know, and that's a perfectly acceptable competitive strategy, one that Cisco certainly employed against other companies in the past, shall we say.
Well, the cat is out of the bag.
And it was fascinating to see that, you know, you could see that obviously, you know, they're both Arista and Cisco are both in Silicon Valley, and there are a lot of former Cisco people at Arista. So you can see
a lot of Arista people now working for Cisco too, by the way.
Just exactly. I think it goes both ways. Traffic goes both ways.
And you can see
that there was a lot of thought put in on both sides. They both knew that these announcements were coming and they thought about, all right, how are we going to differentiate, right? And the optics are certainly one area and so forth. Yeah.
And just to point this out once more, the Nexus 9300s, they're built on Cisco's custom ASICs. I think that they call it the cloud scale ASICs. And I asked specifically, are you going to disaggregate this? They said, yes, it automatically supports PSI, the switch abstraction interface. So for those hyperscaler cloud providers who want to run a different network OS on top and just buy the chassis, they can do that.
Makes perfect sense because, you know, what we're seeing is, obviously, Microsoft developed SONiC, and there have been other contributors within the OCP. We're seeing a lot of interest in that from the Chinese hyperscalers, not just Alibaba.
Yeah.
So if you're going to sell switches to many of these hyperscalers, they're going to want to purchase bare metal, and you're going to have to disaggregate to do that. Obviously, the margins are lower, but vendors still want that business, right?
Because you still need to have volume. If you're going to go with your own switch, Cisco wants the volume. You have to have a critical manufacturing volume to bring your unit price down. And if the enterprise is not going to buy these, like the enterprise doesn't, the big driver behind 400 gig is in the spine, in the top, the third tier of your cloth, you know, maybe in the fourth tier in some cases. And if you can go in there and put 400 gig instead of rows and rows of rack-based chassis, then 400 gig's going to sell pretty well because it really reduces the complexity of the network. So.
Yeah, and Greg, and you made a great point earlier at the outset when you talked about the enterprise not being an early market for this technology, and it's absolutely correct. Yep. But that tells a story in its own. I think a tremendous gulf is developing between, you know, the needs of the hyperscalers in terms of their bandwidth, you know, between racks and so forth, and the enterprise, and it becomes a real challenge for a lot of the standards bodies and the ecosystem, you know, the whole supply chain as a whole. Because, you know, they're becoming a larger and larger share of the market, and enterprise needs within this context are kind of being delegated, not to so much a backseat, but they are being almost becoming secondary over time. And it'll be interesting to see how the market evolves. Yeah,
I agree with you entirely. And one of the things that Drew and I have talked about on the show repeatedly for the last 3 years is that enterprise gets to pick up the technologies that fall off other people's tables. You get the scraps. Days of enterprise being the first market with the leading edge technology. Well, no, the leading edge technology now goes into smartphones. Yep. The leading edge WAN technology goes into 4G, 5G. The leading edge data center technology goes into the hyperscale clouds and so on. And look, even enterprise software is being built on the cloud as SaaS services. So you won't see, there won't be another Oracle providing on-prem data centers for the foreseeable future. And so the enterprise really just gets to pick up the scraps that fall off the side of the table. And that's really, in fact, the whole thing about network break these days is basically picking out which scraps are actually relevant to us.
What crumbs are falling down to the enterprise?
So you're saying that you're working through the scrap heap trying to find diamonds in the rough.
Yeah, well, and which is interesting because a lot of those scraps are being sold as premium products when, in fact, they're technologies that's been monetized somewhere else and really shouldn't be premium pricing. It should be like this is second or third generation technology. Like even the Intel CPUs that go into enterprise grade servers from Cisco, UCS, HP, and Dell, they're not the prime first generation CPUs. Those are going to AWS. They're the custom order ones. Like the FPGA CPUs went to Amazon. They didn't come down to the enterprise first.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you can also see a similar phenomenon in terms of a lot of developments that first occur within hyperscale. There's a lot of work being done by the major OEMs to repackage these and adapt them for the enterprise market.
Yes.
Because obviously they're not in their raw form, they're not consumable by a lot of enterprises, right?
So, well, importantly, you can repackage them and charge a premium price for a feature that you've already developed.
Yes. Yes.
Right. So, because the enterprise is stupid enough to pay over the odds on the belief that, you know, we're getting mystical magic stuff that comes from our trusted vendors, you know, who are inventing this technology just for us to, you know, to blah, 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 blah. And the reality is, no, it's just scraps falling off the side of the table of others now. It really should be getting much cheaper.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, we could probably talk more about this, but we got other news to cover. The next big story for today, and happened earlier this week, is that, Big Blue is getting a little more purple now. It spent $34 billion to acquire Red Hat. That price tag makes it one of the biggest tech deals on record. IBM now owning Red Hat. And the response has not been great.
It would be lukewarm to cold at best. I think the most interesting, probably the single most substantial sign that this is not a great deal is that IBM said it would buy Red Hat at $190 cash per share. And the Red Hat share price is currently trading at $170, which
so IBM's paying a premium.
That's right. So people who you would normally expect, as soon as the price went to $190, then the shares should trade at $190 because that's the market value. And it's not like IBM's offering X number of its shares plus some special issue shares like Dell did, you know, back when it went private and, you know, goes public and blah, blah, blah. It's just, no, we're paying cash, $190 a share. The shares should be valued. So that would indicate that the market, at least, believes that the deal's not going to go through or not going to go through at the price, or there's some sort of risk here. And that, to me, is the most substantial signal that this is not all that it seems.
Although there was a significant breakup fee for Red Hat if they were to.
$1 billion, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I
mean, 930, it's... but let's round it up to a billion.
Right.
So my take is that the response I'm seeing out in the industry is that this is a good for IBM in that it's not necessarily a long shot, but an attempt by them to become more relevant to the way the tech market has evolved, and IBM has not done a good job of keeping it up. So positive for IBM, negative for Red Hat in that the two cultures are not going to fit together and that IBM is essentially going to poison everything about Red Hat that made it successful.
Yeah, well, Red Hat obviously is an open source, freewheeling. We contribute, but we don't know where the money comes from. You know, and eventually we work out, you know, we buy companies like Ansible and give it away. And eventually we'll find a way to monetize it with a service contract. Well, IBM doesn't just has tried open source repeatedly and has been participating in open source projects for years, but really hasn't been able to turn that into a revenue that it can monetize. Now, IBM, of course, its biggest source of revenue is consulting and services. Plus, it's also got the legacy mainframe businesses and so forth, but they're not really substantial. And that services and consulting business has been shrinking for 22 quarters, except for last quarter where it rose by a small amount. And then the next quarter, it started shrinking again. So IBM's got a problem and it needs to do something. And quite obviously, as everything moves into the cloud, IBM is not seen as a cloud company. They tried to make a cloud. They built their own. It failed. They had three or four goes at it and nothing. So actually, the way I see it now is if they spend $34 billion buying Red Hat, that's an all or nothing deal. They're blowing their entire cash reserve on Red Hat. It has to work. So if you look at it from that point of view, it's a make or break, you know, to do or die, all or nothing. Mm-hmm. It's going to spend it all. And they've also announced, IBM's also announced that it's suspending share buybacks in 2020 and 2021. And that's why the IBM share price immediately started shrinking, was because there's no share buybacks to add value. It reduces the value of the stock. So the question is, do you believe that Red Hat can change IBM? And I suspect that the answer is, well, most people would say the answer is no. And if you look at the articles, I've linked to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 articles, and they all say no. I haven't seen one that says, yes, they can do it.
Well, these sorts of acquisitions, you know, they're usually, and Greg, you know this, both of us have been in this industry for a long time. We don't want to say how long, too much. But the interesting thing here is, there's a general rule that the larger the acquisition, obviously, the greater the risk. And we've seen some acquisitions go awry in the past, you know, based on size. And you're right. There are cultural issues with Red Hat and IBM. IBM does have a long history in open source, to your point you raised earlier, but they've used it more as a competitive proxy than as, you know, a profit generator.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see how this pans out. I mean, everybody's watching. There's a lot of skepticism, to your point, right? They all want to see how this integration and assimilation proceeds. And I think there's tremendous pressure on IBM because you're right. I mean, they've invested a lot in this and they have to see it through, or they have to at least figure out how they're going to see it through. But they're going to have to do things a bit differently than they have in their past M&A playbooks in terms of the post-acquisition integration. This is going to be a challenge.
Well, on the positive side, the headquarters of Red Hat is in Raleigh, which is just down the road from IBM. So literally their HQs are in the same town. That's actually a strong factor for success for American companies because they're not very good at being multi-located.
Right. I think proximity is a key point, right? I mean, look way back in networking history, the Synoptics Wellfleet acquisition, the bi-coastal thing, it didn't work out at all. And I think proximity is a huge factor. Yeah.
It is for American companies, less so in Europe and Asia, but in this case, yes. The other thing that I note is that the deal will close in the second half of 2019. That's a year away, right? That's a long time for a deal to go through to completion, especially one that's a make or break for the company. And I think it's possible that could leave Red Hat paralyzed. Can they make decisions? Can they continue to develop new products and make acquisitions until the deal actually closes? That would be something that I could worry about.
Yeah, that's another reason I think the kind of roll-up acquisitions or tuck-in acquisitions usually proceed a lot more smoothly. I mean, obviously the scope is not as large, but generally they close faster too. And when you've got these long closes, it's a period of uncertainty, not only for the employees within the companies, but also for the customers and everybody else, right? The partners, the whole.
Yeah. And I imagine that the recruiters from AWS and Facebook and Google are furiously ringing their Red Hat employees today, telling them, you should come to us.
Right.
It's not like the people who work for Red Hat can only work for Red Hat, right?
Yeah. And I can also imagine all of the other companies that have built businesses around selling support and services around open source software, like SUSE and others, are ringing up competitors saying, hey, Red Hat's going over to IBM. That's bad news for them. Good news for you, because you can work with us now.
It's going to be bad for Oracle, because if IBM has control of Red Hat, then Oracle, which has been forking Red Hat into its own product, could be very interesting. You've also got SUSE. In theory, Microsoft could buy SUSE to get control of a Linux distro that it could recommend to run on Azure. Debian, of course, is an open source in Ubuntu, so maybe Ubuntu is in play as well. And also, for many years, Cisco's been touted as a buyer for Red Hat. They probably, like all these companies are always talking to each other about buying each other for one reason at different times. It is possible that Cisco could suddenly pop up with a deal to buy Red Hat. Again, at $34 billion, this would be a sort of decisive move that we haven't seen Chuck Robbins make. Chuck Robbins has been only willing to spend a few billion dollars to buy a company here and there. Spending $34 billion on Red Hat, because he would have to be competitive with IBM or better, is just, I don't even know. They've got the money, I think, but whether they would be willing to make that sort of bet. But again, Cisco needs to do something to transform itself as the cloud continues to bite into the enterprise.
And they'd probably, to your point, Greg, be the only ones who could jump into the breach and do something. I don't see anybody else other than Cisco who has the means and the motivation or the potential.
Yeah, that's true. So gut feel, I actually think Cisco will make a bid for it. I think it's highly likely that Cisco will get a deal out and we'll see that happen.
Oh, should we put that on the prediction list?
I think we could. I think we should.
All right.
I think I'm going to go with it. I'm not 100%. But I think it's highly likely Cisco needs to, if IBM gets it, Cisco can still get to Red Hat with its partnerships with IBM. But I also think that, Cisco knows that a lot of its business is, it needs a stack. It needs a competitor against Kubernetes. It needs OpenShift and PaaS and FaaS. And if IBM's got that, then its path to market might be bumped. And I imagine that right about now, there's a lot of late night oil being put together at Cisco to decide, make a decision around this. I'll go with, if I have to make a 1-2 decision, I'd say Cisco's going to make a bid.
All right. We'll put that on the list. All right. We got a bunch of other news to cover, so let's keep moving on. Pika 8, they make the Linux-based Picos network OS. They're partnering with Dell to make its network operating system available on Dell's N3000EON open network switches. Pika 8 is going after campus and branch access switches with this move, rather than the data center, which is where we've seen the majority of disaggregated white box / bright box products targeting.
Yeah, and this is a very good move. I think the campus is ripe for change. People have got very old equipment sitting around in their campuses, and they're looking for a way forward. And we know this because Cisco's been banging the SD access drum very hard and pushing, putting the hard word on customers like you wouldn't believe. And the squealing sound is people being pressured into buying something they don't really want. But I think that this is great for Pika 8. They can focus on their resources on software and not on actually having to handle the distractions of hardware, and let Dell, of course, gets to sell hardware to anyone who they can. Sometimes they compete and sometimes they don't. And more importantly, customers can also be reassured that they can switch to other OSs if they need. So if you're running, you know, a standardized Dell chassis and you like buying a brand because you need to buy your Hermes branded handbag, but nothing else will do, well, then maybe you need a brand on your Switch to keep yourself comfortable. And so you can obviously go and run other people's operating system in here. So I think this is a really smart move from Pika 8. Hopefully they can get some traction.
It makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense for both, right? I mean, Pika 8, you know, we've talked about this before offline, Greg. You know, the challenges of cracking that data center market, right? They've taken several runs at it. They saw an opportunity in the campus and the branch, and they I think they made some early headway with some retail customers, price sensitive retail customers who are looking for this sort of technology. And for Dell, it's an extension of their open networking portfolio now out to these environments, right? Not just data center, not just branch with obviously what they've done with on the SD-WAN front, but now they've got this campus play with Pika 8, and I think it makes sense. They'll probably have other options over time, but this is part of Dell kind of bolstering that open networking portfolio and reasserting their commitment to that whole model.
That's right. It gives you a brand on the hardware to make you feel better. It does help you potentially reduce costs against a branded Cisco or whoever. And Pika 8 is also saying, you know, it's a Linux-based network OS, so you can run your favorite automation applications on there. If you're using something like a SaltStack or an Ansible or Puppet or Chef, whatever, we can help you support you so you get that automation benefit for managing a bunch of distributed switches if you're a retailer or some other, a lot of branch locations. That's their value proposition.
Yeah. And I also think moving to the campus and moving out of the data center is smart. People aren't doing anything. I don't think there's much genuine change going on in the data center. People who want to change are putting NSX in, so you don't have to change your switches. Relatively few. That's not to say none. Like, it could be 40, 50% of the market might still go ACI over time.
Yeah.
Mostly, I think data center networks are actually sort of a solved problem.
The other thing that's interesting is that Pika 8, by going after campus and branch, avoids the problem we've seen with folks like Arista and Aruba Networks, who are trying to dislodge Cisco in the campus core. That's a much bigger ask to switch out a core switch than it is to, you know, start at the branch or the edge.
Yep. I would agree. I mean, that's a significant challenge, right? Going after the campus core. And the displacement, the effort to displace is much greater, right? And the resistance is greater. So this is a place where you can make a foray and try to work from there. Yep.
All righty, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. Like it or not, your organization is embracing the cloud. That might be great for the business, but for network architects and IT ops teams, it can be a service delivery nightmare. Why? Because you depend on cloud providers, ISPs, and third-party apps for business-critical services. And even though you don't control these networks, you are responsible for the service delivery, which means if performance is bad, people are going to come looking for you. This is where ThousandEyes can help. You can take advantage of ThousandEyes agents across the cloud and within your enterprise, all the way down to the endpoint. These agents actively monitor network behavior and topologies and how they affect application performance. With ThousandEyes, you can correlate multiple layers of performance data from L2 to L7, including BGP routing and DNS, to quickly identify problem areas and dramatically reduce your mean time to repair. You can pinpoint the root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attacks, and more. And you don't have to keep all this intelligence to yourself. You can easily share events, metrics, and dashboards with your vendors and customers so you can collaborate to resolve problems faster. ThousandEyes also aggregates and anonymizes real-time data from a collective data set so that they generate insights about large-scale issues across the internet, including their severity and breadth, as well as likely root cause. And if all that sounds good to you, we have a special offer. On November 7th, you're invited to Cloud State 2018. This is an exclusive event hosted by ThousandEyes in San Francisco, and they're going to unveil the results of the first annual Public Cloud Performance Benchmark Report. This is a data-driven, unbiased comparison of AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud. You can register now at thousandeyes.com/cloud-state-2018 to find out who wins the cloud wars. Check out thousandeyes.com/cloud-state-2018. And now back to the news. Back to Cisco, they've issued a security advisory for an in-the-wild exploit that can cause ASA and Firepower devices to crash.
Yeah, so there's a SIP inspection engine in the ASA. What's surprising to me, perhaps, out of this is that it's in the Firepower as well. So if anybody sends a specifically crafted attack to the SIP port, then the ASA and the Firepower boxes will crash and die. And some of them will just crash and some of them will just reload. So logically, if you have a SIP gateway being presented to the internet and you're using Cisco firewalls, you need to get in there and check if your models are affected, and then just about all of them are. I just find this, again, sort of the quality around Cisco security products, I've sort of said before, it's generally disappointing. But the fact that they're actually lifting the code out of the ASA and putting it into the firepower boxes would be seriously worrying to many people. So if your telephone call drops are suddenly up today and you've got a Cisco firewall, that's where your problem is, and you need to get some, there's no fix yet. So get over to the vulnerability in the show notes and track that and wait for the code to be patched.
They do say mitigations are available, including disabling SIP inspection, which is enabled by default. And there's also, you can do some blocking of IP addresses. But yeah, there's no fix yet as of the Friday, November 2nd when we're recording.
Yeah. So. Good work, Cisco. Yeah, leaving it on so it just goes. Not a good look. Real lack of professionalism and a lack of quality. Remember, Cisco products come with a 30-day warranty because they're really not very good. So I'm only joking, but that's actually something I often think about.
All right. Yeah. So we'll have a link in the show notes if you need to go check that out, or just go search on the web for Cisco vulnerability.
Sorry, 90-day warranty.
Okay.
Yes.
That's good. An extra 60 days.
It's not a software warranty. It's only a hardware warranty.
Moving on, Foxconn, you've heard of them. They manufacture high-tech products. They are supposedly building a factory in Wisconsin. Website The Verge has a really good story looking at how the state pledged $4 billion in subsidies to get this factory built. But now the deal is falling apart. Foxconn is reducing the size of the promised factory, which also reduces the number of jobs, which is the whole point for the deal. And it looks like kind of a boondoggle.
Yeah. Now, the story here is really a U.S., and it's actually a very localized story in the state of Wisconsin in the U.S., wherever that is. I think the reason I wanted to draw this to your attention is that quite often we see big businesses make big noises, big partnerships, you know, lots of PR and brash statements, you know, and the politicians getting involved in you. And as soon as you see this, your LIDAR should be at maximum sensitivity because there's usually a lot of lies going on, right? So what you want to be careful of here is if you bet your business or your strategy down on when big companies make big promises, there's a fairly good chance it'll come unstuck. And the second thing here is that politics and business sometimes to do mix. And I had a fair bit of pushback over the last few months since I started saying, you know, we've never had politics in technology before, and now we're seeing this come mixed. And this is an example of that. I don't really want to go into this. If you're at all interested in watching how state politics can boondoggling is done, the article's just fantastic.
I think it also relates to Amazon and all the kerfuffle around their second headquarters and watching them make municipalities and mayors and so on do the monkey dance as they try to, you know, pony up the best, biggest tax breaks and other deals to bring in headquarters and jobs. It's kind of gross.
Same sort of thing. Amazon's getting an awful lot of data about certain places for nothing.
Right. A lot of steak dinners. A lot of steak dinners.
Yeah. Not just that, but, you know, literally more data on headcounts and money and revenues and growth and what's being built and what's not. They'll know where to invest for the future because they're getting all that data.
Now, that's a great point, right? They're learning about all these centers and municipalities in terms of education facilities, population mix, everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. What about if they want to build a new fulfillment center? They've got all this information about every one of these towns. And when, if they want to build a new fulfillment center, they'll actually have all the data they need to decide, more data than they would otherwise have. And maybe they say, we didn't build your HQ, but can we get the same deal for your fulfillment center?
Exactly. That's just what I was thinking. Yeah. Yeah. You could get consolation prize behind curtain two.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's all sorts of reasons as to why AWS. And that's exactly probably what's happening here. Same sort of thing. Except in this case, it's a Chinese company, which is not a good look right now.
Right, that's also a thing, yes.
In the US, you know, politics with Chinese companies is a different game now than it was 2 or 3 years ago.
All right, moving on. Yahoo, they have to pay a $50 million fine and provide 2 years of free credit monitoring for users. That's a result of a settlement reached by the company in a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of users affected by breaches back in 2013 and 2014.
Yeah, you know what? $50 million fine, it's probably cost more for the lawyers and the research and the preparation for the lawsuit than they actually paid as a fine.
And actually, I have to correct myself. It's not a fine. They'll have to pay $50 million to folks who file claims that they were affected by the disclosure of their personal information by, say, like identity theft or something. That's what the money is being put aside for, and also paying lawyers, yes.
So nothing. So I think my point would be is that the cost of IT security, like if you figure that Yahoo's going to pay out, $100 million? But they got to get away with a much lower security posture for 6 to 8 years. That's good. That's good money. That's good profitability. Mm-hmm. You know, why would you invest in security?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's, you know, to your point, Greg, it sounds like it's an opt-in for compensation too. And not everybody, of course, is going to opt in, right? So,
Yeah. Well, here's how it breaks down. You can get $375. $375 if you are able to document that you do, like you suffered identity theft or something. And you also have to file a claim and go through all the paperwork to get it. If you just want to file a claim, you can maybe get $125. So nobody's getting rich on this, but the lawyers.
No.
Yeah. Well, I think the flip side here is that if you're going to have a discussion around IT security in the business, you need to say that the security needs to be cheap enough because the penalties are so low. Okay. So even if you get breached, even if you leak all that information and people get it, I think that the customers don't care anymore because they're so used to hearing 50 million, 200. It doesn't matter if you get breached and the data leaks. What you need now in the modern era is a cost-effective, low-priced IT security strategy that gives you enough deniability to say we did good, but don't overinvest in IT security is number one. And number two, the price of IT security has to match the impact, and the impact is actually trivial, as we consistently see proven.
Yeah, absolutely right. As also part of the deal, they have to provide credit monitoring services for anybody who asks for it for 2 years.
Some people must have lifetime credit monitoring.
At this point, I think it could be up to a good 10 years now based on all the breaches that have gone on. All right, moving on, Extreme Networks, they have announced quarterly earnings. They posted $240 million in revenue for the quarter, which is up 13% year over year, although they did also post a net loss of $9.1 million.
So good results for them, obviously, more than was expected, and they also, sales are up. So that means, in theory, their sales organization and the merger of the business is starting to come together well, which is a good sign. And at $240 million in revenue, they're half the size of Arista.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah.
Which isn't too bad. So I just wanted to put those quick points out there. They did make a loss slightly larger than expected, and they also missed their earnings per share. So they didn't deliver quite as much profitability as was expected. So it's a bit of a mixed result in some sense, but interesting to note, you know, the size of Extreme as they merge, and they seem to be getting through the merger quite well. Good work by Extreme,
I think. They were very clear that when they bought Avaya assets and Brocade assets, that it was going to contribute to growth right away. And so far that's being proved out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It took them a little longer to get the Brocade business point in the right direction, but I think they're on the right track now, no question. And these acquisitions are, you know, never easy. We talked about it earlier, right? It takes a significant amount of post-integration or post-acquisition effort to complete the integration. And it looks like they're coming out the other side now, which is good news.
Yeah. Yep.
Sticking with financial reporting, Arista also reported quarterly numbers. The networking company has revenues of $563 million, up almost 29% year over year, and a net income of $168.5 million. Not bad.
Yeah. By comparison, Extreme doesn't look in such great shape because they had a 13% growth, but Arista boggles it out with 29%.
Yeah.
And Cisco's not doing anywhere near that. They're doing a few percentage of both. So I think the great thing here is that Arista, of course, had a 30% share price drop a while back due to some news. So the 7% shot pop doesn't actually mean all that much at the end of the day. But do keep in mind that at $580 million of revenue in Q4, which is pretty much all data center and cloud, that makes Arista getting close to Cisco's entire Nexus product line. I'm not quite sure just how much the billions are for Cisco's data center switching business, but Arista must be getting up to, what, half the size, Brad? Maybe this is something you know something about?
Not quite, but they're definitely closing ground. It's been steady, right, in terms of market share for the last several years. You know, there's as you said, they haven't yet begun, at least not reflected in the past quarter's results, right? You're not seeing any of the new campus products. So this is all data center. And they continue to punch well above the weight of the rest of the market in data center switching. It's definitely a success story that's been sustained. And now they're trying to add another chapter, right? I mean, now they're going after that campus business as well, and we'll see how that turns out. It's a little bit of a shift for them, but they've certainly got a track record that indicates you'd be unwise to underestimate them.
Very good. All right, this is our last topic for the show. We had talked a little bit earlier about company culture and the ramifications it can have. Thousands of Google employees around the world staged a walkout last week to protest the search giant's policies around sexual harassment, including huge payouts to executives accused of sexual misconduct. I'm calling the story out in part because I see it as part of a trend over the past year where Google's business practices have directly clashed with its, you know, like, do the right thing, don't be evil culture. We saw protests over Google's proposed censorship-friendly search engine that they want to deploy in China, and employees protested and resigned over Google's work with the U.S. Defense Department, which eventually led to Google canceling the contract. So you know, Silicon Valley has built this mythos around its companies where they get so much, you know, glowing press coverage and publicity about how they're changing the world and helping people and doing the right thing. And now their employees are actually trying to hold them to account for that kind of marketing pitch.
Which is interesting because there's a couple of different angles on this. First of all, employees at big tech companies actually have some amount of power.
They have leverage.
They have leverage, right? They can actually, these companies are actually desperate for employees if you believe what they say. And there's only a certain type of person who works for them. And in some cases, there's only a certain type of idiot who wants to go and work in Silicon Valley, right? So not to say that they're all in Silicon Valley. But the flip side of this is, you know, you can't help but think of the word like unions. You know, back in the day, this used to be done by unions.
That's right.
And we don't seem to have that happening. And I'm really quite baffled by the whole thing. You know, it's like unions used to do this. And now when these people self-organize, people are getting all bent out of shape. It's like, okay. So, but it is a good thing, though. I do think that it's something that's worth, we should see happening. If you've been hired onto Google with the promise of don't be evil, and if you're delusional enough to believe that you're working for the good of the world while you work for a corporate surveillance organization like Google, and, you know, you must be a certain type of dumb to conveniently ignore the truth, if you know what I mean.
Well, I mean, I respect the fact that they're actually trying to hold Google to its professed values. This is something that Google, since its very beginning as a company, has professed as a value. Do the right thing. Don't be evil. So their employees are actually like, well, hey, that's part of what we signed on for. Let's live up to that. And I think it's great. They should be doing that. It's also interesting that you see the backlash against other companies like Uber and Facebook have come through the media and through the government. This is internal. This is happening by employees inside the company, which again, I think ties right back to culture.
It does. But they were often hired on these people were often hired on and fed some sort of delusional stuff about, oh, you're working for the good of the world. You're going to make everything open and you are empowering people with knowledge while conveniently forgetting that you're exploiting everybody's personal data to whore ads to them.
And that's been the entire, you know, sort of gloss over the entire Silicon Valley, you know, model since its inception, or at least in the last 10 or 15 years, is that we're building these things to make the world better when in fact we're just, you know, using them to surveil you and suck up money. And so we're seeing this marketing stance that they've taken is now coming home to roost, and people, the gloss is stripped off. The ugly truth is there for everyone to see. And now they're having to reckon with it, which is it's time for the reckoning.
Yeah. The tech lash,
the tech lash. Brad, any comments?
No, I think you guys covered it. Right. And it just shows how it's all interconnected today. Right. When you get these sorts of controversies, they reverberate throughout an organization today. And I was thinking about it, you know, it wasn't something that we probably would have seen. It certainly wasn't as common just a short years ago, but it's a changing world. And this is all the interconnectedness that I guess technically possible.
It's coming back to bite them. All right. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Network Break. Brad, thank you so much for joining us. If folks want to look you up, where should they find you on the web?
I'm at Brad Casemore on Twitter. I don't get to tweet as much as I used to, but I still try. So they can find me there. And that's it.
All right, good. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
You can find me on the YouTubes, where, because I wouldn't want to have a network break without talking about SD-WAN at least once, because we haven't talked about it the whole show this week. I published a YouTube video this week on Viptela on iOS and why this is a great move for customers, especially people who are Cisco customers and like to be part of the branding exercise that Cisco puts out for you. So if you're a big fan of that, get over to YouTube, search for Packet Pushers, and you'll find our channel and get an interesting take on that sort of a discussion. And of course, I'm blogging occasionally over at Packet Pushers.
All right. I'm Drew Conroy-Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. And I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsor, Thousand Eyes. And of course, thank you for joining us for yet another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, tell people on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or just tell people about it. As always, thanks for listening.